You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 11th. I'm Amanda Martin from Drake University. Here's our first story. St. Albert's Thunderstruck Robotics Team to take on invaders Saturday. An army of robots is expected to invade St. Albert High School gym on Saturday. The school is hosting a robotics competition at 8:30 a.m. It will start with robot troubleshooting and inspections. Matches are expected to begin at 12:30 p.m. or shortly afterwards. It will be the second meet of the season for the school's team Thunderstruck, according to Andrea Barnes, who coaches the team with Lynn Gardner. Both are parents, not St. Albert teachers or staff members. Last weekend, the team launched its season with a competition at Marion High School. 17 of their league's 21 teams are expected to participate. The team has 8 to 10 trained volunteers who will help run the competition, along with team members' parents. The tournament will be based on the FIRST Tech Challenge, capital FIRST. Matches last 2.5 minutes, with the first 30 seconds for autonomous robot operation. The object is to make the robots lift cones that correspond to your team's color and place them on poles of different heights. For best results, operators make their robots do a Viper lift and place cones on the tallest poles. The taller junctions are worth more points, Barnes said. Teams can also get extra points by forming a line or pattern, called a circuit, with their cones across the field. The last 30 seconds are the end game, when teams can score extra points by putting a self-designed beacon on top of a pole. Thunderstruck has a dozen members this year, Barnes said, including seniors Sammy Harvath, Abby French, Mackenzie Pearson, Claire Lewis, and Nolan Smith. Juniors Lily Barnes, Olivia Gardner, sophomores Cody Kirkman and Hunter Weintischer, and freshmen Alex Marsh, Ben Hoy, and Kellen Underwood. We're really excited to have 12 members, she said. We only graduated one senior, and we got 4 new members. Team members can learn a variety of skills, Barnes said. Everybody's given the opportunity to do everything, she said, by helping design, build, program, and drive the robot. Teams also have to give a presentation to the judges and explain why they built it the way they did. They keep an engineering notebook, which they must show to the judges. This is their robot, Barnes said. They research it, they design it, they're sometimes watching videos to learn how to program it, and they build it. The team actually built 2 robots, one for competitions and one prototyping robot, she said. They use it to try out new ideas. If they work, they can modify the competition robot. If not, the competition robot is still intact and ready for action. Thunderstruck enters 5 league competitions each year. If it qualifies, it can advance to a super qualifier competition and then state. After this weekend, the team's next competition will be at Creighton Prep. Veteran Affairs Director resigns. Tension with VA Commission, by David Golbitz. Exactly 9 months to the day, she was sworn in as Director of Pottawatomie County Veteran Affairs. Rita Dooley tendered her resignation. Her last day on the job is, coincidentally, Veterans Day. Dooley's resignation is the culmination of what appears to have been a tenure rife with policy disagreements and miscommunication between her and the 5-member Veteran Affairs Commission. We're all aware that there have been some difficulties in communication between the commission and the director, County Attorney Matt Wilbur said at the November 8th Pottawatomie County Board of Supervisors meeting, where he asked the board to accept Dooley's resignation and approve the severance agreement that was worked out between Dooley and the county. According to the agreement, Dooley will receive the remainder of her salary through the end of her contract, which would have been June 30th, 2023. The remainder will be paid to Dooley as a lump sum on her last day of employment, November 11th. The agreement stipulates that Dooley releases the county, including the Board of Supervisors and the Veterans Affairs Commission, from any future claims with regard to her employment. Dooley also waives any right to future litigation and agrees to withdraw any pending charges, complaints, or lawsuits before the Iowa Civil Rights Commission or the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The county also agreed to pay Dooley's attorney, Ray Aranza, $3,500. During the November 8th supervisor meeting, Wilbur stressed that all parties only want what's best for the county's veterans. Sometimes the vision of how best to deliver those results is the subject of disagreement, Wilbur said, and the best way forward is simply to hit the reset button. I believe this agreement does that and does it amicably. The Daily Nonpareil reached out to members of the board and VA commission and to Dooley and her attorney, all of whom declined to comment further. Really, nothing more to say, Aranza wrote in an email. The agreement speaks for itself. Per state law, the VA commission is in charge of the hiring process for a new director. Once the commission has selected someone, the applicant goes to the county board for approval. With two new supervisors joining the board, the hiring process is not expected to get underway until January. The clash between Dooley and the VA commission came to a head at a brief commission meeting on July 22nd, during which the commissioners voted unanimously to fire Dooley for cause, according to the meeting's minutes. Dooley was not in attendance for this meeting, and the meeting itself lasted only 2 minutes. The exact timeline of events leading up to and following the July 22nd VA commission meeting is unknown, but some information is publicly available. At the July 26 supervisors meeting, the board filed a payroll status change for out-of-class pay for longtime VA caseworker Peggy Becker, according to the minutes. The VA commission approved a motion at its August 8th meeting to add acting office administrator to Becker's casework 3 job classification with an increase in salary retroactive to the July 26 supervisors meeting, indicating that Becker had taken on the director's duties. Dooley was not in attendance at the August 8th meeting. According to the meeting minutes, the last commission meeting she attended was July 11th. According to the severance agreement, at some point after the VA commission July 22nd meeting, the Board of Supervisors reviewed the concerns of the Veteran Affairs Commission and declined to approve Dooley's termination. However, in talking with Dooley, the board agrees that a continued employment relationship would be difficult, if not impossible, for Dooley under the present circumstances. At that point, the board agreed to accept Dooley's resignation, effective November 11th, as outlined in the severance agreement. Two Retired Service Members Ready to Help Other Veterans Start New Careers, by Tim Johnson. Veterans seeking employment will find a team on their side at Iowa Workforce Development. U.S. Air Force Sergeant Thomas Bryson, retired, veteran career planner, and Army First Sergeant Rick Honeycutt, retired, local veteran employment representative, specialize in helping veterans plan their civilian careers, prepare for employment, and find job opportunities. Bryson, a native of Colorado Springs, Colorado, and graduate of Colorado Christian University, served as an Air Force Administrative Services Coordination Specialist for 20 years. Honeycutt, originally from Sioux City, spent 21 and a half years as a military policeman specializing in training and handling military working dogs. He now serves veterans in the western one-third of Iowa, traveling among Iowa Workforce Development offices in Council Bluffs, Creston, Sioux City, Denison, and Spencer. Having gone through the transition from active duty to civilian life themselves, they help veterans build their resumes and translate skills they learned in the military, whether or not they were directly related to their specialization, into civilian terminology. If a guy was a tanker, we have to find out the skills he had besides being a tanker, Bryson said. They use a website that shows different military careers and their parallels in the civilian world, if there are any, Bryson said, who served as an administrative services coordination specialist for 20 years. Some translate directly to civilian jobs and some don't, Honeycutt said. And some veterans may not want to do the same kind of work they did in the military, he said. Honeycutt and Bryson can advise job seekers when they need further training for the work they would like to do, Bryson said. Honeycutt advocates for veterans with businesses and finds that most employers are very receptive to hiring veterans. They have a work ethic, leadership skills. They're not afraid to step up and do something when it needs to be done, he said. Said Bryson, all the branches kind of have the same mindset, doing what's right and getting the job done. At Iowa Works, they see veterans of various ages and backgrounds, Honeycutt said. We're seeing a lot of the older veterans at this point, he said. They may be Vietnam veterans who have retired but find they need more income, or younger vets who need to find a good civilian career, Honeycutt said. What's nice is the military has a transition program for them, he said. However, once a service member is discharged, they can't return to their base, Bryson said. We pick up from there, he said. Honeycutt or Bryson will remind them to look for benefits, as well as decent pay, and will help them prepare for interviews. They also help veterans who have extra challenges. We work with individuals with significant barriers to employment, Bryson said, adding that spouses are also eligible for this kind of assistance. Barriers may include age, disability, homelessness, low income, lack of civilian work experience, and other factors. We're definitely there for veterans that really need that extra help, he said. Iowa Works can also refer veterans to programs such as adult basic education, vocational rehabilitation, or dislocated worker if needed, Bryson said. During his military career, Bryson served mainly as a customer service specialist, contributing to base morale, recreation and welfare, and large-scale event planning and coordinating, according to his bio. He deployed to Prince Sultan Air Force Base, Saudi Arabia, Manas Air Base, Kyrgyzstan, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, Sather Air Base, Iraq, and Talil Air Base, Iraq. He also completed assignments at Goodfellow AFB, San Angelo, Texas, Peterson AFB, Colorado Springs, Colorado, Cheyenne Mountain Space Force Station, Colorado, and U.S. Strategic Command, Nebraska. Once he retired from the Air Force, Bryson worked as a sales executive, administrative coordinator, and civilian employee at Stratcom. He decided to stay in Council Bluffs with his wife, Kim, daughters, Katie, Amanda, and Billy, and Newfoundland puppy, Chocolate. After retiring from the Army, Honeycutt worked as a canine officer at a prison before transferring into investigations. After 10 years, he joined the Kansas State University Police Department as Director of Security at K-State Salina. After that, he returned to Iowa to be closer to family. He and his wife, Chris, have two adult sons. Official: Council Bluffs Early Learning Center Construction on Schedule by Tim Johnson. Construction of the Early Learning Center is proceeding as planned, an official said during the Council Bluffs Community School District Board of Education meeting on Tuesday. The 38,000-square-foot facility will house both preschool and child care programs and is expected to serve about 200 children when it opens in August of 2023. Work began on April 18th and is scheduled for completion by June 30th, 2023, according to Daryl Meyer, project manager. The steel framework is now in place, as well as some concrete block walls, and metal studs have been installed, he said. The center will have 14 classrooms, including 11 for preschool, 2 for toddlers, and 1 for infant. There will be large and small motor skills rooms, as well as offices, workrooms, storage rooms, a multi-purpose room, and a kitchen. District officials have been working on strategic planning for the center with representatives from the Iowa Department of Education and consultants from the Juniper Gardens Project at University of Kansas, according to Tracy Matthews, Chief Academic Officer. The state is anxious to find out if the center can be a model for combining early education and K-12 school systems elsewhere in the state, Superintendent Vicky Murillo said. We're really excited to be leading the way. The building will have a secure entrance and will be equipped with 16 indoor surveillance cameras and 22 outdoor cameras, Meyer said. We'll have card readers on every exterior door, he said, because all of the classrooms are going to some kind of playground. There will also be card readers on the playground gates, Meyer said. The rooms for infants and 1 and 2-year-old toddlers will have a heated floor, since they are likely to play on the floor. Tubes for a radon mitigation system will be built into the facility. If radon levels in the completed building are above recommended amounts, a fan can be added. Efforts have been made to minimize the impact of any supply chain issues, Meyer said. We've ordered every single thing that we possibly can, he said. Furniture will probably be ordered in January, he added. The project is expected to cost $17,706,211 including 14, just about $15 million for construction, $1,118,000 for professional fees, $783,000 for equipment and furnishings, $234,000 for land acquisition, and $603,000 for other costs. The total also includes $978,852 for contingencies. The project and a $2.24 million endowment will be funded with a $7 million state grant, $5 million from the school district's Secure and Advanced Vision for Education Sales Tax Revenue and Physical Plant and Equipment Levy, $4 million from an anonymous lead donor, and a $1.04 million grant from the Iowa West Foundation, $1 million from another foundation, $100,000 from American National Bank, $100,000 from Dr. Burroughs and Christiane Rasik, and pledges from other private foundations and individuals. Police vs. Firefighters, Epic Eating Contest to Raise Money for Veterans by David Golbitz. The Council Bluffs Police and Fire Departments are going head-to-head this afternoon in a contest of physical endurance and mental fortitude to raise money for area veterans. Blood might be shed, and there will almost certainly be tears, as some of the city's finest first responders compete to see who can put away the most barbecue ribs in the name of interdepartmental rivalry. The winning department earns bragging rights, while the losers suffer shame and indignity. Everyone will endure the meat sweats. The police and fire departments will also be competing in a bucket challenge, according to a post on the CBPD Facebook page, and the departments will be auctioning a hero basket. The Chowdown Showdown will take place today at the Texas Roadhouse, 3231 South 24th Street from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. All proceeds will be used to help veterans in need. The restaurant will also be open for lunch for the holiday. Face of the Day, Jigsaw. Jigsaw is one of many Midlands Humane Society animals looking to be the missing piece in your puzzle, and now is as good of time as any during the PetSmart Charity's National Adoption Week. Jigsaw is a 3-year-old Mastiff mix who is currently available for adoption at Midlands. Shelter staff members say that although she is a big lady, she has a soft personality. Once she warms up to you, though, she'll be your best friend. She was an owner surrender due to having chronic allergies, so that is an ongoing condition future owners will have to take care of. She's been taking antibiotics and receiving baths at the shelter and has been doing well. Her adoption fee is $225, which includes a microchip, altering and age-appropriate vaccines. In other news, Midlands is currently in the middle of the PetSmart Charity's National Adoption Week. It started Monday and runs through November 13th. The shelter will be working with a local PetSmart, 815 McDermott Street, to get as many animals adopted as possible this week. Midlands representatives have been on site with cats, dogs, puppies, and kittens at various times this week. They'll be at PetSmart today and Sunday from They'll be at PetSmart Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. to celebrate the end of the promotional week. More information about fostering, volunteering, and donation opportunities can be found at MidlandsHumaneSociety.org or by calling 712-396-2270. Like their Facebook page to keep up with daily shelter news. The shelter can also be found at Midlands Humane on Twitter and at Midlands Humane Society on Instagram. Second error in Linn election caught as state results finalized. Linn County initially reported more absentee ballots than it received, by Aaron Murphy, Gazette Des Moines Bureau. For the second time this election week, state elections officials spent Thursday dealing with an error in Linn County as the statewide county of Iowans' votes from Tuesday's election was completed. In addition to a recalculation of Linn County's vote totals due to an error in the reporting of its early vote counts, partial recounts were also conducted Thursday in Warren and Des Moines counties. The partial recounts were ordered by Iowa Secretary of State Paul Pate after irregularities were discovered Tuesday night. That completed the tallying of all results from Tuesday's elections and resolved a couple of outstanding races. All election results in Iowa are considered unofficial, however, until they are reviewed and certified by the state's canvassing board. State Auditor Rob Sand appears to have won re-election for a second four-year term. Because of its narrow margin, the outcome of that race has been in doubt while the final results were tallied. According to the unofficial results, Sand, a Democrat, defeated Republican challenger Todd Halber by 2,614 votes out of a nearly 1.2 million votes cast. Since Sand's victory margin is less than 1%, Halber, by state law, can request a recount without being required to post a bond. Halber did not return a message seeking comment Thursday. If the result holds, Sand will be the only Iowa Democrat to win a statewide race in this election. Iowa Republicans won the campaigns for U.S. Senate, Governor, Secretary of State, Attorney General, Secretary of Agriculture, and Treasurer. And with Linn County's votes finally fully tabulated, but still unofficial, Democrat Elizabeth Wilson won a close race for an open seat in Iowa House District 73. Wilson edged Republican Susie Weinacht by 300 votes, according to unofficial results reported by the Iowa Secretary of State and Linn County Auditor. Those unofficial results in Linn County came Thursday, only after a recalculation of the county's vote totals due to a second error made by the county auditor's office. According to the Secretary of State's office, Linn County reported 600 more absentee ballots than the office had actually received at the time the polls closed. The discrepancy was discovered by the Secretary of State's office, which then alerted the Linn County Auditor's Office. The Linn County Auditor's Office resolved the tabulation of the county's votes, and then posted results were corrected, the Secretary of State's office said. According to the Linn County Auditor's Office, a computer froze while the county's absentee ballot counts were being uploaded. The process was completed on a backup computer, but officials believe 600 ballots were inadvertently reported twice, once during the original attempt and again during the backup attempt. According to the Secretary of State's office, the Linn County Auditor's Office failed to verify those vote totals before publishing the results on election night. A spokesperson for Pate's office said that this is a basic review process recommended by the state office in multiple training sessions made available to local elections officials. Pate, a Republican, and Linn County Auditor Joel Miller, a Democrat, were the candidates in the Iowa Secretary of State election Tuesday. Pate won and earned a fourth non-consecutive four-year term as the state's top elections official. It was the second error made by Miller's office this election. A county supervisor race was left off the ballot in one Linn County precinct. The Secretary of State's office is reviewing that transgression, and Miller may face penalties under a new state law that heightened penalties for local elections officials who violate state elections law. The state auditor and House District 73 races are among eight in Iowa that had not yet been called by the Associated Press as of late Thursday afternoon. Another uncalled race is in House District 42 in Ankeny. According to the unofficial results, Democrat Heather Mattson defeated Republican Garrett Gobble by just 24 votes out of roughly 14,000 cast. Gobble announced Thursday he will ask for a recount. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, November 11th. On IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Amanda Martin from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Obituaries. Bayo R. Elenick. Bayo R. Elenick, age 89, of Council Bluffs, passed away November 8, 2022, at the Florence home in Omaha. Bayo was born February 21, 1933, in Council Bluffs, to the late Remo and Mary Lecca Elenick. He graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1950 and proudly served his country in the U.S. Army during the Korean War. Bayo married Patricia Wilde on November 16, 1957. They were blessed with four children, Susan, Marcia, Mark, and Anna. Bayo was a brick mason for ASARCO for 35 years, retiring in 1993. He was a member of the American Legion Post No. 2 and the VFW. In addition to his parents, Bayo was preceded in death by his wife Patricia in 2005, brothers Stephen and Peter Elenick, and his sister Angelina Hannafin. Bayo is survived by his children Susan and Brad Hutchinson of Las Vegas, Nevada, Marcia and Greg Richwine of Elkhart, Iowa, Mark and Kimberly Elenick, Anna and Paul Addison, all of Council Bluffs, eight grandchildren, Dana, Derek, Stephanie, Nicole, Phelan, Corey, Casey, and Kaya, nine great-grandchildren, Eliana, Cameron, Carter, Navia, Sophia, Madison, Reagan, Kennedy, and Theodore, one brother, Joe Elenick of Elmhurst, Illinois, four sisters, Christina Buchholz of Council Bluffs, Sylvia Espinosa of Crescent, Iowa, Yvonne Dorman of Prescott, Arizona, Helen McCashland of Detroit, Michigan, and many nieces and nephews. Visitation with the family will be Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel. Funeral service Monday at 11 a.m. at the funeral home. Interment Memorial Park Cemetery with military rights tendered by the American Legion Post No. 2. A luncheon will follow at the Walnut Hills Reception Center, 1350 East Pierce Street. Memorials are suggested to the Alzheimer's Association. Now on to sports. Eagles face the Falcons in the semis. By Austin Heinen. The Underwood Eagles are back in the Unidome for the first time since 2002 and just the second time ever in program history. Waiting for them is the defending state runner-up West Sioux. This year marks the fifth time in 6 years that the Falcons have earned a spot in the semis, including last year when the Falcons denied the Eagles a trip to the quarterfinals. However, revenge is not on the Eagles' minds, as their only focus is to play their best football. They are going to be a major challenge, Eagles coach Nate Mekulson said. We know from playing them a year ago that our defense is going to have its hands full. But in the end, it doesn't really matter who we play. We've been looking forward to this game, and we want to do everything we can to continue our season. We have a lot of respect for their program, not just from last year, but because of what they've done in previous years as well. The Falcons and Eagles' offenses look very similar on paper. The Falcons have a senior quarterback in Dylan Wiggins, who has thrown for 1,800 yards. But also has a solid run game with senior running back Carter Boltman, who has run for 1,124 yards. The Falcons also have a key receiver in Brady Linnett, who has 15 touchdown catches and 803 yards receiving. Long story much shorter, this Falcon offense is loaded with weapons. They can throw and run the football in a similar way that we do, the coach said. We execute each part of our offenses in different ways. They have multiple playmakers on the field at all time. They have three guys that run the ball effectively. Their quarterback is very talented and accurate with his arm. They have a handful of guys that can catch the ball, and their line plays very physically. They're such a multidimensional team, it's hard to get a beat on exactly what they're going to do. They're as dynamic on offense as anyone in any class. They can score on any play. The Eagles know what they have to do if they want a chance in this game. They have to play well against a team that is very familiar with the semifinal atmosphere. Underwood vows that they are not content by just making it to the Dome again. Their goal this week is just like any other week. Prepare to try to win a football game. We're going to have our hands full. They are a great team, but we know that they're a great team too. But we know that we're a great team too. Mekulson said, we've been talking a lot about not taking things for granted, and we're not going to take this experience for granted because we're not guaranteed this again moving forward. We're going to approach this like a business trip. We're coming to Cedar Falls to do one thing, and that's to win a football game no matter who it is. That is our goal every Friday night, and this will be no different. Underwood and West Sioux will kick off at 1 p.m. on Friday in the Unidome in Cedar Falls. Underwood is looking for its first ever state championship game appearance. Making a statement, Titans wreck Wildcats in semifinal. Titans score on first drives to trounce Wildcats by Austin Heinen. Class 4A number 1 Lewis Central football beat Class 4A number 5 Carlisle for the second time this season, this time in the state semifinals at the Unidome, 42-21. The Titans scored touchdowns on their first 5 drives and 6 of their first 7 drives to dominate the Wildcat and earn a trip to the Class 4A state championship game. We talked about it all year, and especially before this game, about the importance of starting fast. Titans coach Justin Kamrad said, "We know they love to run the football, so we want to force them into passing situations. And our kids really hit home here, especially on the defensive side. We knew we had to play assignment sound, and I can't be more proud of how our guys executed on both sides of the ball." The Titans only had to wait for their second play from scrimmage before a 58-yard run from Jonathan Humpel put the Titans up 6-0 just 42 seconds into the game. The Wildcats, on their opening drive, moved the ball to the Lewis Central 24-yard line before the Titan defense stopped the Cats short on the fourth down. After the fourth down stand, the Titan offense marched down the field and capped off the drive with a touchdown, with Braylon Kamrad connecting to Curtis Witt from 12 yards out to take a 13-0 lead in the end of the first quarter. "We were focused and locked in from the start," Braylon Kamrad said. "We had a lot of momentum boosters to start with, and we just kept rolling." The future UNI Panther commit completed 21 of his 28 passes for 285 yards and 3 touchdown passes on his future home field. The second quarter was more of the same. A 38-yard pass from Kamrad to Witt put the Titans up 20-0 early in the quarter. The Titan defense struck again as Jack Doolittle recovered a fumble on the Carlisle 27-yard line and Kamrad connected to Parker Heller, who went the full 27 yards to make it 27-0 Titans with 9 minutes to play in the second quarter. The Titans were not done, as an interception on the Wildcats' next drive eventually turned into a 6-yard jet sweep from Boston Hensley. After a 2-point conversion, Lewis Central held a 35-0 lead. "We knew they wanted to come out and play physically with us," Witt said. "They want to bully us out of the way to open their run game on defense and shut down our offense. We said all week that we weren't going to let that happen. We were going to be the bullies, not the victims." Witt caught five passes for a team-high 88 yards and 2 touchdowns. Notably, Parker Heller caught a team-high 6 passes for 84 yards and also had a touchdown reception. Jonathan Humpel also added a nice punch on the ground with 92 yards rushing on 9 carries. The Titans would add another touchdown as Jonathan Humpel ran in his second of the day late in the third quarter to make it 42-0. The Wildcats would score 2 offensive touchdowns in the second half and a late scoop and score in the final moments of the game, but the damage had already been done. After losing its first 3 appearances in the semifinals, Lewis Central is now on its way to the state championship game for the second consecutive year. "The chance to defend the title has now presented itself," Justin Kamrad said. "We haven't even talked about that yet, and honestly, we try to stay away from that. To us, this is more about going out and winning another game next week. I'm very proud of our coaches and kids to put ourselves in this position. All year, we just keep telling ourselves it's just another game, and every week is just another week," Witt added. "We're just going to stick to the same routine, practice hard, and return here focused. We've been playing with the mindset that we're not trying to repeat, we're trying to win," Braylon Kamrad said. "We're the ones being hunted, and we have to remain the aggressors. We're going to prepare the same way, regardless of who we play. We're going to lock in and have a great week of practice and be focused when we come back here." The Titans will play for the Class 4A state title on Thursday at 7 p.m. Screenplay, a look at the week ahead in college football. TCU can clinch berth in conference title game, by John Zenner, Associated Press. Number 4 TCU has a chance to wrap up a spot in the Big 12 conference championship game, but who would play the Horned Frogs for the title could remain very much in question. The unbeaten Horned Frogs take a 2-game lead into Austin to face number 18 Texas, which is part of a 3-way tie for second. The Longhorns, number 23 Kansas State, and Baylor are all 4-2 in the league. Kansas State and Baylor face off this weekend as well. TCU would clinch the top spot in the championship game with a win. It's pretty jumbled from there. Texas is coming off a win at Kansas State, which already lost at TCU. Baylor's final three games are Kansas State, TCU, and Texas, so the defending Big 12 champion Bears control their destiny and trying to get back to their title game. The other three games matching ranked teams include number 6 Oregon at number 24 Washington, number 10 Alabama at number 11 Mississippi, and number 16 Tulane versus number 22 UCF. Best game. TCU, 9-0-6-0 Big 12, number 4 CFP, visits Texas, 6-3, 4-2, trying to stay on a path to the college football playoffs. TCU is seeking its 5th win against a ranked team, which would match Tennessee as the most this season. The Horned Frogs are 7-3 against Texas and 4-1 in Austin since joining the Big 12 in 2012. The game features the big league's 2 top rushers, Texas' Bijan Robinson, 1,129 yards, 12 touchdowns, and TCU's Kendre Miller, 1,009 yards, 12 touchdowns. Numbers to know, 133. SMU quarterback Tanner Mordecai passed for 7 first-half touchdowns and 9 overall in a 77-63 win over Houston. The 133 combined points was an NCAA record for a regulation game. 171. Alabama has had national championship implications in 171 of its last 174 regular season games since 2008 heading into this week. The other 3 times it wasn't in contention all came in the 2010 season. 334. Temple's Edward Sadie, 265 rushing yards, 69 receiving, and Kansas's Devin Neal, 224/110, both totaled 334 all-purpose yards, tied for the 2nd most in the FBS this season. 17. San Jose State's 17 sacks are the most in back-to-back games in at least 10 years, according to NCAA records. That includes 8 sacks against Nevada and 9 against Colorado State. Hot seat. West Virginia coach Neil Brown needs to win out to become bowl eligible after dropping 3 straight games. A closing slate of Oklahoma, Kansas State, and Oklahoma State makes that a tough challenge for the Mountaineers, 3-6, 1-5 Big 12. Brown is 20-24, approaching the stretch run of his 4th season. Under the radar. A top 25 matchup doesn't usually qualify as an under-the-radar game, but number 22 UCF at number 16 Tulane is worthy of a little extra spotlight. It's the first time a ranked Tulane has hosted another top 25 team since a 1949 game with LSU. UCF's John Rhys-Plumlee, who missed the Memphis game with an injury, has passed for 1,883 yards and run for 532. Mikey Keene proved a capable sub if he's called on again. Tulane's Michael Pratt has passed for 1,843 yards and run for 251. Study: Mindfulness Worked as Well for Anxiety as Meds, by Lindsay Tanner, Associated Press. Mindfulness meditation worked as well as a standard drug for treating anxiety in the first head-to-head comparison. The study tested a widely used mindfulness program that includes 2.5 hours of classes weekly and 45 minutes of daily practice at home. Participants were randomly assigned to the program or daily use of a generic drug sold under the brand name Lexapro for depression and anxiety. After 2 months, anxiety as measured on a severity scale declined by about 30% in both groups and continued to decrease during the following 4 months. Study results published Wednesday in the journal JAMA Psychiatry are timely. In September, an influential U.S. Health Task Force recommended routine anxiety screening for adults, and numerous reports suggest global anxiety rates have increased recently, related to worries over the COVID-19 pandemic, political and racial unrest, climate change, and financial uncertainties. Anxiety disorders include social anxiety, generalized anxiety, and panic attacks. Affected people are troubled by persistent and intrusive worries that interfere with their lives and relationships. In the U.S., anxiety disorders affect 40% of women at some point in their lives and more than 25% of men, according to data cited in the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force screening recommendations. Mindfulness is a form of meditation that emphasizes focusing on only what's happening at the moment and dismissing intrusive thoughts. Sessions often start with breathing exercises. Next might be body scans, thinking about each body part systematically, head to toe. When worrisome thoughts intrude, participants learn to briefly acknowledge them, but then dismiss them. Instead of ruminating over the troubling thought, you say, "I'm having this thought, let that go for now," said lead author Elizabeth Hoag, director of Georgetown University's Anxiety Disorders Research Program. With practice, it changes the relationship people have with their own thoughts when not meditating. Previous studies have shown mindfulness works better than no treatment, or at least as well as education or more formal behavior therapy in reducing anxiety, depression, and other mental woes. But this is the first study to test it against a psychiatric drug, Hoag said, and the results could make insurers more likely to cover costs, which can run $300 to $500 for 8 weeks of sessions. The results were based on about 200 adults who completed the 6-month study at medical centers in Washington, Boston, and New York. Researchers used a psychiatric scale of 1 to 7, with top number reflecting severe anxiety. The average score was about 4.5 for participants before starting treatment. It dropped to about 3 after 2 months, then dipped slightly in both groups at 3 months and 6 months. Hoag said the change was clinically meaningful, resulting in noticeable improvement in symptoms. 10 patients on the drug dropped out because of troublesome side effects, possibly related to treatment, which included insomnia, nausea, and fatigue. There were no dropouts for that reason in the mindfulness group, although 13 patients reported increased anxiety. The study is reaffirming about how useful mindfulness can be practiced effectively, said psychologist Sheehan Fisher, an associate professor at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, who was not involved in the study. Dr. Scott Krakauer, a psychiatrist at Zucker Hillside Hospital in New York, said mindfulness treatments often work best for mildly anxious patients. He prescribes them with medication for patients with more severe anxiety. He noted that many people feel they don't have time for mindfulness meditation, especially in-person sessions like those studied. Whether similar results would be found with online training or phone apps is unknown, said Krakauer, who also had no role in the study. Olga Canestraro, a freelance writer in Keene, New Hampshire, participated in an earlier mindfulness study led by Hoag and says, "It taught her to intervene in my own state of mind. During a session, just acknowledging that she was feeling tension anywhere in her body helped calm her," she said. Canestraro, 52, has generalized anxiety disorder and has never taken medication for it. She was a single mom working in sales during the earlier study, circumstances that made life particularly stressful, she said. She has since married, switched jobs, and feels less anxious, though she still uses mindfulness techniques. Pumpkin Boat Ride Down Missouri River Nets Guinness World Record by Margie Ducey, Omaha World Herald. A Nebraska man has made the Guinness Book of World Records for longest ride by pumpkin boat paddling after he paddled down the Missouri River this summer. Dwayne Hansen, who lives outside of Syracuse, set the record August 27th with a trip stretching 37 and a half miles. The previous record was 25 and a half miles. The first person I called was my daughter, Hansen said, after getting the official email from Guinness on Monday, November 7th. She was pretty happy. Hansen rode a hollowed-out 846-pound pumpkin down the Missouri from Bellevue to Nebraska City. It took him 11 and a half hours. Hansen said the following 3 days were a blur, with newspaper and TV interviews from around the world. I didn't realize it was such a big deal, he said. But at the time, it still wasn't officially the longest pumpkin ride. Hansen's daughter, Morgan Buchholz, was in charge of all the paperwork that had to be submitted. There was a lot. When Guinness reached out with some questions a few weeks ago, the two decided to take it as a good sign. Some of the evidence Buchholz had sent in didn't make it the first time. They had to submit some GPS tracking evidence, and Hansen had to supply the receipt for the kayak paddle he used. Anything not available commercially can't be used in setting a record. Thank goodness my wife saves the receipts for everything, he said. Now that he's the official record holder, Hansen has a new goal. And of course, it involves a big squash. As wife Allison said, everything is pumpkins, pumpkins, pumpkins. It takes up a lot of my thinking time, Hansen said. Hansen is now aiming to take over the Nebraska record for largest pumpkin of 1,492 and a half pounds, held by Brent Cernick. He also wants to grow a pumpkin large enough that he and his daughters can ride down the river together. She's all for it. The answer will always be yes. His dream is my dream, Buchholz said. If he grows a pumpkin, I will be right there with him. And I'm sure he will. Salute to those who served. A look at the annual observance that honors military personnel, past and present. Veterans Day facts. How does it differ from Memorial Day? Memorial Day is a time to remember those who gave their lives for our country, particularly in battle or from wounds they suffered in battle. Veterans Day honors all of those who have served the country in war or peace, dead or alive, although it's largely intended to thank living veterans for their sacrifices. Why celebrate on November 11th? World War I officially ended when the Treaty of Versailles was signed on June 28, 1919. However, the fighting ended about 7 months before, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. For that reason, November 11th, 1918, was largely considered the end of the War to End All Wars, and dubbed Armistice Day. On June 1, 1954, at the urging of veteran service organizations, Congress amended the commemoration yet again by changing the word armistice to veterans, so the day would honor American veterans of all wars. Why isn't it Veterans Day? The holiday is not a day that belongs. Why isn't it Veterans Day, V-E-T-R-A-N apostrophe S? The holiday is not a day that belongs to one veteran or multiple veterans, which is what an apostrophe implies. It's a day for honoring all veterans, so no apostrophe is needed. Michelle Obama shares personal stories of coping in book by Darlene Superville, Associated Press. Michelle Obama said she struggled with a crushing sense of hopelessness after the 2020 presidential election that was brought on by the death and isolation of the COVID-19 pandemic, a summer of political and racial unrest, and the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. I was in a low place, she said. Then she got an idea. Everyone was searching for some answers on how to cope. And for some reason, they were asking me, what do you do? I had to start thinking about that, the former First Lady told People magazine in an interview pegged to Tuesday's release of her second book, The Light We Carry, Overcoming in Uncertain Times. She is set to open a 6-city book tour in Washington on that day. In the book, former President Barack Obama's wife, who is one of the world's most famous women, tells how she steadies herself during these anxious times and how she works at overcoming her lifelong fear of change and doubts about herself. Over the 58 years that I've lived, I can look back and I can say, this is how I deal with fear. These are the things I say to myself when I need to pick myself up. This is how I stay visible in a world that doesn't necessarily see a tall black woman, she said. This is how I stay armored up when I'm attacked. The book is that offering. I think people learn not through edict, but through stories, she said. People posted a report on the interview on its website on Thursday, and it will appear in the magazine's November 21st issue, available nationwide on Friday. Mrs. Obama, the mother of Sasha and Malia Obama, opens up in the book about everything from how awkward it is to make new friends to her experiences with racism, marriage, parenting, and even menopause. She also writes about leaning on a kitchen table of close girlfriends, led by her 85-year-old mother, Marian Robinson. The group includes Kathleen Buell, a hiking and yoga pal, who is the ex-wife of President Joe Biden's son, Hunter, and the mother of Maisie Biden, Sasha Obama's best friend. In 2018, Mrs. Obama released her best-selling memoir, Becoming, and embarked on a U.S. and international book tour to promote it. The book has sold more than 17 million copies worldwide, surpassing the sales of any memoir by a previous first lady or modern president, including her husband. In her new book, the former first lady describes looking in the mirror and only seeing her flaws and how she practices being kind to herself. She said she also copes by indulging in what her husband calls lowbrow TV. You name it, I watch it, she said, naming HGTV, anything on the Food Channel, and dating shows like Married at First Sight, among her viewing choices. The former First Lady described herself as an informed citizen who reads the newspaper, gets briefs, sits with her husband every night, and knows what's happening in the world. But she said that when I'm by myself, I need to be able to turn my head off and think about wallpaper. Forecast. Cold front is here. Skies are sunny, but today's high of 32 will not break the threshold of freezing, according to the National Weather Service. A north-northwest wind gust could gust as high as 25 miles per hour at times, and gusts as high as 21 miles per hour are expected tonight. Tonight will be mostly clear with a low around 18. The forecast, according to the Weather Service, today, sunny with a high near 32, north-north gust wind 13 to 17 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 25. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 18, northwest wind around 11 miles per hour, with gusts as high as 21. Saturday, sunny with a high near 31, north-northwest wind 5 to 10 miles, with gusts as high as 16 miles per hour. Saturday night, mostly clear with a low around 17. Sunday, partly sunny with a high near 37. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 23. Monday, partly sunny with a high near 38. Monday night, a slight chance of snow showers. Mostly cloudy with a low around 22. Tuesday, mostly cloudy with a high near 35. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 20. Wednesday, partly sunny with a high near 34. Movie review. Spielberg turns lens on his youth. Fableman opens today in theaters by Katie Walsh, Tribune News Service. I need to see them crash. These are the first faded words of the future filmmaker, Sammy Fableman, whispered to his mother, Mitzi, after he crashed his toy train after bedtime, inspired by his very first big screen cinematic experience, The Greatest Show on Earth. Mitzi instantly recognizes that recreating the train crash is a way for young Sammy to exert some control over the fear he felt during the movie, and so she presents him with his father's 8mm camera to capture and replay the crash. With this lesson on art as a catharsis imprinted in his young mind, a movie director is born. In the deeply personal The Fablemans, legendary filmmaker Steven Spielberg applies his artistic instincts to his own familiar catharsis, turning his lens on his own upbringing, his childhood journey to becoming a filmmaker, and his parents. What could have been some kind of auto hagiography is a playful, honest, and ultimately gracious childhood memoir that derives its universal lessons from its specificity. The Fablemans is simultaneously the story of how a filmmaker comes to be, the product of an artist and an engineer, and a reckoning with, or setting the record straight about, his parents' relationship, which has been shared before in interviews and in the 2017 documentary Spielberg. It is also, on a more spiritual level, an attempt to capture the drive to be an artist and what following that dream entails, and philosophically about what it means to see or be seen through the lens of a camera. Spielberg and co-writer Tony Kushner pack a lot into The Fablemans, but first and foremost, it is funny and warm and loving and complicated in an authentically familial way. Much of this comes from Williams' performance as Mitzi, which is specific and big, but always feels real. Mitzi is wild and wonderful, a concert pianist who feeds her family on paper plates because she refuses to do dishes and risk her hands. She is fascinating, frustrating, immensely loving and lovable, and ultimately unknowable, especially by her husband Bert, a sensible engineer working on the development of computers. Sammy knows his mother because he sees her through the viewfinder of camera and later winding through his reels in 8mm footage. What he sees, he does not always like, especially when it comes to Mitzi's friendship with Bert's best friend, Benny. But Sammy and Mitzi are too similar, possessed of an artist's heart that cannot be denied. In their darkest moments, they are both selfish and scared, as his sister Reggie shouts at him. But Mitzi's dreams and her dreams deferred become Sammy's guiding light as he fumbles towards his calling. A film so intimate and revealing about one's own family could end up being somewhat maudlin, but Spielberg's filmmaking is lively and even mischievous. Working with longtime cinematographer Janis Kaminski, Spielberg deploys a signature fluid camera style, but he employs whip pans and record scratches and little playful jogs on the camera to find a horizon line. The approach isn't just amusing and endearing, but a reminder that Spielberg's still just a kid who loves making movies, as he loves his family, as messy it might be. With The Fablemans, Spielberg asks us to have a little fun and to remember our childhood love of the movies, but he also makes a profound statement about how he seeks others through his filmmaking and, in that process, how he himself is seen. In this delightful meta-memoir, he allows us to see him, too. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for November 11th. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Amanda Martin from Drake University in Des Moines. Thanks for listening.